Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to open up the subject of death and dying and talk about all sort of subjects around it. And today I'm really delighted to be joined by Lucy Easthope, who's written a couple of books which have been very well received all over the place. I've heard a lot of her on the radio recently. The first one was When the Dust Settles, which was all about stories of love, loss and hope around disasters, because Lucy is an expert on emergency planning and disaster recovery. And then your second book, Lucy, is called Come What May, and that's to do with life after a disaster, isn't it, really? But what I really wanted to say was listening to you talking about disasters and what happens to people afterwards and communities afterwards and how people are helped or not helped reminded me very much of just a single bereavement and what it's like to go through a single bereavement. It seemed almost everything you said resonated with me, really. Do you agree?
Oh, completely. And thank you very much for having me. And thank you for such a lovely introduction. That was exactly what I hoped to do, particularly in Come What May. And what had happened with When the Dust Settles was it was this very big response to these big disasters. But when I was at the book events, people would take it home and they would tell me how it resonated. And then I realized, well, there's a second book here about bringing this home, bringing it into the single loss, still unexpected, all the behaviors that we try and almost police in disaster. So toxic positivity, bad help, knowing what to do, being worried about saying the wrong thing, allowing people to slump. Those were all things that worked big and small. So that was entirely the point of Come What May, really.
But going back to your first book, let's start at the beginning. Can you just sum up the things that you found that people did that were good and things that people did that weren't so helpful?
Yes, and I think one of the things about working in disaster was people had made lots of assumptions. You know, you must see the best of people, for example. And actually, sometimes you see the worst. Sometimes you see incredible state failings. And I think one of the things that I've become very sort of advocating and campaigning about is sometimes there's a lot of parallels with the big iconic disasters and people who perhaps lost a loved one in a hospital that where they feel they've made mistakes, you know, cover-ups, how to live with that betrayal and cynicism. So there was lots of things where people would say, you know, I really brought that home. The other thing about When the Dust Settles was it really shone a light on a world that people just did not know. And that was a bit of a revelation even to me. I had assumed people knew that before events there was quite a lot of detailed planning, there would be responses at the event. And then afterwards, there were people like me who'd made aftermath and advising on aftermath their niche. But what happened with the pandemic was we became a dirty secret. You know, the whole kind of taking the country with us in those first few months was the cabinet and the government saying, this is new, this is unexpected, come along with us on this journey we're all figuring out together. And we became hidden. So even sort of appearing and doing any media was a bit of an act of rebellion. So the biggest thing with When the Dust Settles, I think, was people, you know, the revelations, lots of people went on a similar journey to me, that the disasters that I talk about, 9/11, the Bali bombings, the tsunami, Grenfell, marked their life too. Even if they weren't directly involved, they felt involved. So that sort of chimed. And then what was really powerful, I'd do a book festival and then I'd sort of hide nervously in the cafe and I would hear people. And of course, your podcast is all about opening up and talking about things. And they would say things like, they'd never, ever, ever given any thought to something like the disaster victim identification process, which is how we identify bodies and body parts in the event of a disaster. And then we end up asking mums and dads and husbands and wives terrible, terrible, very difficult questions on day one of the worst start of many worst days of their lives. And listening to people saying, I've never thought about personal effects like that. What somebody goes through my handbag and returns it to my family after I've died. I've never thought of it like that. And I thought, wow, I didn't expect that to be revelations. And that showed that I've been sort of living in my own head a bit, really, I think.
People's responses to disasters, officials' responses to disasters, one would like to think is laid out in advance. You're saying it may or may not be. But what about individuals' responses to disasters? Because presumably different people react in completely different ways.
Oh, very, very, very much so. And that's a big, Oh, yeah. You know, what I've loved with writing Come What May is like the naughtiness of it, being able to write a chapter 8 on survivance, which is however you decide to deal with illness, death, dying, grief. This is your path and your family's path. And, you know, there's a lot of grief policing that goes on in my world. So people, you know, you see some of our biggest laughs were at my dad's funeral. We lost him in 23 and he had exactly the funeral that mirrored the way he'd lived. Lots of silliness, a massive pot of cream was accidentally spilt all over the sandwich platter. It was everything he was in life. And I think sometimes, and you watch the very recently bereaved look very nervous about crikey, people have just seen me laughing. Is that okay? And you see it in hospices as well. And I think one of the things that I wanted to write about was the importance of all your needs. So there's a chapter called Needful Things about, you know, needs that are hidden. We write these very censorious Victorian lists of how we think people in disaster will need. You know, they will need food, good food, and they will need this. But, you know, we don't talk about them perhaps needing sex or needing to be very angry with responders. So our impact assessments are a surprisingly sort of kind of prudish, and I love challenging all of that. And that's another chapter called Needful Things, because you know one of the big things in the pandemic, for example, was it had really mirrored an experience that I'd had responding to the Salisbury incident, which was where the business impact assessments were only about the businesses of the day. They were never about the evening work or the sex work or the sex clubs or and one of the things for me was, you know, what understanding society and understanding humans involves us knowing all about each other in terms of what people do and are and need. And the pandemic and Salisbury both produced these very sort of idealistic, censorious impact assessments. And that would take me back to something that I see a lot with personal effects. So one of the things that I'm passionate about, and this is the thing I'm probably proud of most of, because it's the thing I fight for the most, is that people have the right to personal effects back from their loved one or from the scene. And quite often you will see an awful lot of censoring goes on there by responders. So things, and we do it in hospitals and hospices and care homes, anything damaged, anything with bodily fluids, anything that the responders decide is not appropriate. I don't just sound completely bedroom obsessed, but it's usually things like condoms or Viagra, any kind of, you know, lots of censoring I discuss in the book is things like what used to be called lads mag, so the loaded and the zoo of the 1990s. And so these were the sorts of things where I would see responders just very discreetly take them out before they were returned. And that had really stayed with me about the choices we make about what's okay in death and dying. And I do think there's been some wonderful books like Lucy Pollock's books about, you know, particularly with growing older or having illness or going into any kind of hospice or hospital, about, you know, being you and being allowed to have your needs.
Interesting what you say, because it's other people's judgment on us, isn't it, really? I mean, you can understand why somebody might remove a condom or a lad's mag, but it's their opinion. It's not the person who had that object in the first place, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's a lot of value judgment in disaster, how you should behave. You know, we've had a long history. There was even a sort of protocol in the 90s that one way to see whether families were guilty was to put them at a press conference, to see if they knew something more in a murder, you know, investigation or something. So this grief policing, I think, is a really big part of things like British and American culture. So if you're at a vigil and the camera pans and two of the mums are laughing, you know, over you know, a bonded shared moment, the camera will make terrible judgments of that. And of course, then we also now see accusations of things like, you know, it was a hoax or they aren't really grieving. So I really want to be a big challenge about what is normal or what is to be expected in grief. And then the other thing that I think the disasters had given me was this very strong belief in what's called the disaster recovery graph, which is a sort of series of phases and difficult adventures that happen after disaster, slightly different from something like Kubler-Ross, which was that there is this very, very intense honeymoon period for the first few weeks, often, not always, but often after both bereavement and major tragedy and events. And that can become very intoxicating for either a community or a family. But then what would follow it? And it's, I'm finding it's getting shorter and shorter now. It used to be about 12 weeks. Now it's about 8. I don't know what that says about the state of the world. Is a massive slump in mood. But also, as many bereaved listeners will know, the help dries up a little bit. People start to cross the road. People stop talking about, you know, the person you've lost. And so I think that people, when you put a book out, you don't know what people will do with it. But seeing people respond to the graph has been very affirming. It's not my graph. It's 100 years of disaster research. I've just drawn it again for the book.
Well, that was the thing that resonated particularly with me. And you have the story about people bringing lasagna to individuals, which I suppose you'd compare to people hurrying in to look after anybody after a big disaster. Yeah. And the time that that takes to, just as you say, go away and dissipate.
Yeah. And and you feel, you for a brief moment, you feel, gosh, I'm totally wrapped in these arms. And then the arms go. And a real test, I think, so one of the chapters in Come What May is about good and bad help. And one of the things I want people to really feel comforted about is how to give help. And whatever works is whatever works. And I'm constantly challenged. I'm constantly surprised. It's not like I have a very rigid route map all the time. But for example, sometimes with bereavement, letting somebody know that you're there, but then returning, you know, almost setting a clock by it. You may never need a clock because you may just be thinking about the other person all the time. But coming back the 1 month or the 3 month and saying, how are you doing today? You know, like a lot of grief writing and the wonderful memoir by Jill Halfpenny says, you know, sort of shrink the question down. How are you doing today is very important rather than how are you? But also, and I do think this is has been a big issue for my mum's generation, which we've talked about a lot, each other. We've really done our own kind of grief exploration together. And she was very interested in the literature, is that she felt her generation, she'd never thought of it before until she was bereaved. They don't really want the answer to that question often. You know, and it's posed in the sort of salad aisle at Marks and Spencer's. So if you ask the question, by God, you know, you have to make the space for it to be answered and for you to stay active listening. And I think watching people's reactions to her through my eyes, watching her, has been very powerful for me. And a lot of communities will say to me, flooding, Grenfell, you know, all around the world, the sort of united experiences, I'll say it about 8 to 12 weeks, people are bored of us. And that's what I think a lot of bereaved people would say.
And then when you get to something like 3 years, which I am, people assume everything's fine.
Oh, the biggest lie of all, you know, and that's been a lovely thing about the media around Come What May is I think I'm always grateful when other people have started to say the same thing. So I'd had quite a lot of correspondence and resharing on social media with Reverend Richard Coles. And of course, he both in the madness of grief, but also I remember a really important moment on, of all things, you know, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And he said, it doesn't go away. It's just this great big hole that you sort of navigate around. And actually, the bigger you fake it, the more I think people think that it has gone away. And I think, you know, one of the themes in Come What May is Wrexham, the mining disaster, which was very close to home. And I have a sort of intense obsession now with the documentary series about Wrexham. If you know, that's on Disney and it's lovely. And it's a real sense of a town only really reawakened at the 90-year point after a terrible colliery disaster where, you know, 255 of its men and boys are wiped out and then they're kept underground. They're sealed underground. And in disaster literature, there's a lot of discussion about, well, isn't that just burial? And it's, of course it's not. You know, the rites and the rituals, the bringing out, the saying goodbye. And this community was very, very, very badly affected by it. And one of the very clever things that the Hollywood owners, Ryan and Rob, have done is that they've recognised that you have to acknowledge and memorialise and give voice to the loss. And what I've come to realise, and me and my mum have decided we're absolutely fine with this, is it will not get any easier. It will not get any smaller, losing Dad. And there are those absolute pummeling moments, aren't there, where you're just floored at the extent of what you're missing and what you've lost. And that won't leave us. And the amount of toxic positivity that people showered on us, you know, and me and mum started to play a secret bingo game, you know, and we count like it's he had a good life. Yes, yeah, still too bloody soon, you know, he still would have liked to see a bit more. He didn't suffer, he wasn't there. And the other thing I'd learned from disaster was a lot of people don't know. they don't know whether he suffered or not. They don't. So I think one of the things was in disaster work, we'd really started to challenge the good lie. And I'd done a podcast with Michael Rosen on the language of disaster response on the BBC Sounds website. And one of the things that I talked about was the good lie, you know, which we get a lot in bereavement, don't we? That it's things like, you know, he wouldn't have felt a thing. He didn't suffer. And these kind of things are people projecting what they need you to hear. And of course, one of the things that happens in disaster management is that often those good lies are blown wide open at things like instant inquiries. And then families will never trust the responders again. And I think what we're seeing with a lot of bad healthcare deaths at the moment is it leads to a lot of healthcare anxiety because people feel very let down. So what we try and do when we're training responders is don't tell the good lie either. You know, if you don't know, you don't know. And I think that's the other thing about what you do, which is amazing. And what I want to do a little bit in come what may is we're going to be bereaved a lot more. And one of the things about the life after a pandemic, which we knew and we'd planned for years for what life after a pandemic might look like, that was what emergency planning was as well as the virus deaths, you would always see a kind of difficulty in society where more people perhaps would die at home. Ambulance response times would get harder. They'd die where people would be asked to give CPR, so they'd always feel like they hadn't done it properly. They'd always leave questions. And I think, you know, I don't believe in a hierarchy. And often I think people try and say, you know, they had a great death and therefore it's easier. The loss is the loss. But I do think what we're seeing at the moment in societies like ours is a lot of ambiguous loss, a lot of unanswered questions. And that's all adding to the grief at the moment.
And that goes to a long way to explain why some people who've had a tragic loss in a hospital or, you know, a stillborn baby or something like that, why they hang on to it. For a long time. Seems to the rest of us they might be hanging on for a long time, but for themselves, yeah. Like you say, it's to do with getting answers and understanding, isn't it?
I think one of the big things, and I really worry, because sometimes when something becomes a zeitgeist or a real moment, then there's a backlash almost, you know, a bit like the slump. But obviously society at the moment in the UK has started to talk a lot more about things like stillbirth, the loss of neonatal babies and miscarriage, and also validated miscarriage at a much earlier gestation. And that's something that I wrote about in When the Dust Settles. And I was sort of, you know, it was very, very jarringly brought home to me yesterday because there was some very horrible critique of the memoir of Nicola Sturgeon, and whatever your politics or whatever your views, I wonder whether sometimes what we're finding in memoir is sometimes editors and publicists are saying, sort of, go there, tell a bit of a difficult story. And of course, one thing you have to be very comfortable with, which I always was with my own writing, is once it's out. You know, that's a big part of this kind of confessional, even with podcasts. You know, this is a couple of podcasts I've done, I've thought, did I just say that recorded? Wow. But I think one of the things, you know, that just because of her politics, people then have been horrible. And sometimes you think, wow, Nicola Sturgeon might be not seeing her social media, but other mothers who've just miscarried are. And this invalidation of it as a life experience has really shocked me. And I do write about my own miscarriages. And again, in this quite interesting, I think, forensic context, because the paperwork that you use for miscarriage in the hospital and the loss of a baby and before 24 weeks and the decisions around how to do the care and management of the remains is the same paperwork with some word changes that we use in disaster. And I think all of this sort of, again, when I was sort of speaking to audiences, I realized the big is at home too. And I think one of the things, When the Dust Settles is my very, very, very proud memoir, but sometimes it was a little bit hard to gift to somebody in crisis or had just been lost, because just lost somebody, because it goes to some quite difficult places. But come what may, and I'm costing myself a fortune, I've got rid of all of my own author copies. Come what may is quite an easy book to gift, because you go, crikey, you're going through a hard time. You know, and it's gonna be very, you know, not arrogant enough to think it can help too much, but maybe when you're ready. But the biggest revelation has been people, and actually particularly men, who have said to me, I don't know how to help, usually a partner, and I've sent them the book. And there's a chapter in Come What May about hopium, which can be quite challenging because hope's considered so important, you know, and I always say it's right there in my surname as well. But hopium is about too much hope. And that can become very paralyzing and maybe not make you realize you need to get help or you need to get a diagnosis or you need to sit down and have some chats. And a lot of men have reached out to me to say it's the hopium chapter that's really made them realize they had a lot of hopium and they liked my writing about hopium, but maybe their partner or their son or whatever had a lot of hope and they sort of had to meet the person where they were. And that's a real privilege. You know, I've had some lovely chats with men about that. I think men are perhaps more, I don't know, all the women that I work with have great intuition and superstition and empathy and instinct. But I do think sometimes the hopium has talked to people who might be sort of trying to be more matter of fact, which is obviously sometimes a trait that we see. So it's just been interesting to see what people do with each chapter, really.
And everyone's different. I mean, you've got your optimist and your pessimist to start with, haven't you, before you bring in...
Which is why I like to be an optimistic pessimist, is the way... You know, because you live your life with great joy, and I do, and I think people thought it was a big shtick, you know, a good thing for a literary festival to say, I live with great joy. They'd be like, you could tell people in the queue at the book signing, we're trying to get closer to see how drunk you were. You can't really be this perky. And then, you know, Dad dies right in the middle of sort of thinking about a second book. And you think, oh, okay, fate, you've really sent the ultimate test here because, you know, this man, he's absolutely shaped me, complete rock. Am I who I said I was? And I think there's a little bit of the story arc there in Come What May. And what the book, the problem is with giving the book away is you obviously need people to buy the book, but the book's doing exactly what he was. He was a terrible businessman. He never made any money from his building and joinery business because he always did people favours. And that's one of the great things about this stage of loss is he's everywhere. Everybody shows me his benches and his shelves and his... some lovely nursery school gates that he made and doors and all sorts. Everybody's got a bit of him. And then also he'd have loved the book to just help. Have a book. And my husband's going mad because he's Amazon and my I've got my wonderful Booker bookshop that I get all my books from. That I buy sort of my books and then give them away. He's like, this isn't the business model. But I just, you know, it's hard times and you just want people to be okay. And there's so many half lives being lived, aren't there, because of trauma and distress, and I just want people to still feel some joy or some delight. And I had that conversation with my mum recently because I suddenly saw her start to properly laugh again. One was a really raucous poetry reading with Poetry Night Out with the wonderful poet Luke Wright. Really rude words. I'd never seen my mum laugh at those words. And then the other thing was the kids' show. They did Moana in the sort of summer show. And I saw the joy again. And it's, I think, I'm not, you know, the danger, as we said, with the recovery graph is that people will see the joy. I'm sure you will smile or laugh and people go, oh, good, you're doing much better.
Absolutely.
And that's the fallacy, but you're allowed your moments of joy.
But in the meantime, you're feeling guilty.
Oh,
because you don't think you should be laughing or smiling or enjoying anything. I can remember that stage. I can remember precisely getting to that stage and thinking, oh, I've actually enjoyed something. Mm. And you're pleased, obviously, to start with. And then you think, oh, gosh, I probably shouldn't have done that, should I? Shouldn't be ready yet.
It's. I don't know if you've had this, but I think one of the things I'd said in the disaster work was it brings me in very proximate to very good psychologists and very good grief psychologists and some psychiatry as well and other types, spiritual perspectives and all sorts. And I never presumed to have an answer for my mum, but sometimes when she would sort of talk about the guilt, we'd explore it a bit. I wouldn't go straight in with the toxic positivity. But the good thing about Dad was he was just so pleased if she was happy. And so there was a lot of, you know, there was no question that his definitive setting would be that she would be able to feel happiness again. And also, I think one of the things, and you know, the things like Kubler-Ross and other discussions and lots, I mean, I've got lots of bereavement books, and she chose when the time was right to read certain things was, you know, how to deal with things like anger. So often in disaster, the anger, there's definitely a place for it to go. You know, usually there's some horrible state failing. But what it does do is trap you if you stay angry for a very long time. And anger and bitterness are very toxic to the body and to yourself. She says she's never been angry at him, but I could tell when anger was the primary kind of Kubler-Ross feeling, because kind of the world was the world was not right at that point. And I think one of the biggest surprises for all of us in the family, which I hadn't encountered before except with the pregnancy loss, sometimes when I lost the babies, I would wake up and think just very briefly I was still pregnant, and I'd be like, oh, and then you'd remember. But with Dad, what really blew my mind was you do genuinely forget they're dead for a bit, don't you? And I've said hello to big men in supermarkets, like, oh, there you are. Yeah. I thought you meant like a denial that was very conscious and you kind of argued with yourself. I didn't realize it was that joy of magical thinking trickery that you would hear them, you would see them. My mum followed somebody. She's like, oh, he's there. He's been in the town centre all the time. And wow, they just don't tell you all these things. They call it a denial in the face of a graph, but they don't tell you you'll seriously question your sanity in a coffee shop in Shrewsbury. You're like, there's my dad. So I think living some of those has been very important. And I think one of the things I'm starting to worry a lot about with our responses to UK tragedy is that we're fundamentally interfering with those processes sometimes. So governments, for example, really like the honeymoon phase after disaster. They like communities to stay with the big lasagna phase, arms around, lots of flowers. Those affected feel, very, very loved. There's lots of kind of I heart the place that happens. And the government get very cross, both, all governments. I've worked with coalition, Labour and Conservative governments. They want that phase to stay, and they start to meddle and they start to add in additional kind of ways to try and keep the honeymoon phase going. And the other thing that I feel is a lot of intervention happens to try and stop people feeling any pain. And sometimes I think they feel pain anyway, but I think sometimes it's about genuine compassion for the people. And sometimes I think it's about if they feel too much pain, they might riot, they might get angry. So there's a lot of feeling manipulation going on. And I do worry about what that does to people's grief.
Are you talking about sending counsellors into a school, for example?
It's interesting because, there's some really good advice that we get. Again, this is the thing about people not knowing that there's emergency plans and emergency planners. So one of the things, for example, with tragedies in the UK is we'll immediately be able to access really good advice. For example, just recently I had an incredible seminar from a specialist in Los Angeles who specialises in school shootings. And there's, you will take good advice from them, for example, to do what we call watchful waiting, but have the resources ready to go. So have support if it's needed, but see what the children want. Allow the children to have agency and voice. But sometimes that's kind of steamrolled by a government department and they need to be seen to be doing certain things. So one of my proudest roles is as a trustee of a children's charity at the base of the Grenfell Tower. And one of the things that being in disaster response had allowed me to do was say to the amazing trustees and managers of that charity, year one will be terrible, but year eight will be worse. Year 16 will be truly horrifying. And I think one of the things that meant was they've continued to fight. They continue to fight for funding. And we're seeing a very good example of what we call in disaster response intergenerational trauma, which had been well known from things like the Holocaust and genocides, where babies born into the disaster consider themselves survivors and have very profound needs. So we have little kids of 5 and 6 who have very, very important needs. And one of the things we offer is art therapy. But what the founders of the charity, and particularly the amazing Susan Rudnick, which I really wanted to celebrate in come what may, what she'd always said was, you couldn't do art therapy on a sort of empty stomach or without play space. And it's amazing, I think, how many disaster responders find themselves supporting charities, particularly for children. With this, that's where the sort of pure optimistic hope kicks in, I think.
Can we come back to what you said at the very beginning, and you've just referred to it again there, about your work being hidden, and you'd referred to COVID almost as if you felt you and your colleagues were kind of ignored at the point of COVID. Is that what actually happened?
Yeah, very much so. It's often, I think, easier for sort of leaders and what we call the gold command, to sort of throw all the plans out the window and therefore also the planners, and then go, you know, this is all new and different. Let's blue sky think this. And of course, there was also a cabinet at the time that very much praised and prized kind of wild card thinking and, you know, tech bros and all of this kind of thing, and the VIPPP lane and all that sort of thing. But of course, you're also a planner in the lead up. So one of our biggest pandemic exercises in 2016, I've been a pandemic planner as part of my portfolio of plans since 2004. And what we'd seen under the coalition was pandemics are the sort of things that are very easy to cut the funding to planning for because the world doesn't know they're there or as a risk. So things like our PPE stockpile have been decimated, and the stockpile isn't held in a cupboard, it's rotated. And there'd been a number of kind of legal wrangles over the NHS logistics. We couldn't get meetings in the diary to pandemic plan. And I think one thing for us, I'm not normally a big fan of public inquiry sort of happening so quickly because sometimes it gets in the way of things like criminal processes. But the good thing with the COVID inquiry is it's come quite fast and has shone light on our work and how much of it was ignored. And one of the good things about the COVID inquiry is that Lady Justice Hallett, Baroness Hallett, had presided over the July the 7th inquest, which basically sat as an inquiry in 2011. And she, from that, you can see she knows emergency planning and plans and planners. And that's great in a chair of an inquiry because she's not letting people get away with, which you do sometimes see at inquiries, oh, this is all new and different. And it had happened before with Grenfell that a lot of the pre-planning was either hidden or deliberately lied about. And that had prepared me with an extra skin, I think, for when the pandemic happened. And that was strangely therapeutic because then I could get my younger colleagues and new colleagues through. Because to watch plans that you've written, for example, how to not necessarily open schools, but certainly open spaces where children could get out of violent homes, for example, that was something we'd risk assessed years before. To see that kind of plan thrown out of the window is heartbreaking. So I think, you know, what's been very powerful for me in the pandemic is that as a profession, we've reared our heads more, we're speaking louder. And a review of Come What May that really meant a lot to me was in our professional magazine this month. And it just says, which moved me to tears, that I'll always be to them our Lucy. She always was, you know, this is an account of losing her dad, but it's also an account of always championing her emergency planning and her colleagues in emergency planning. And that, you know, you sort of start to think that's all I could have done, really.
It's such wonderful and valuable work that you do. And it's just shocking to hear that it can be sidelined by the whim of a politician who comes and goes. Oh, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. And it's hard. And I think one of the things that the work has helped me deal with, which is a very big part of grief and bereavement, is regret. I try to have as few as possible. And to live very comfortably with your choices. And Dad, you see, one of the great things about Dad, and this isn't possible for everybody, and I'm not advocating a sort of Mary Poppins existence, but we genuinely lived, and people again thought this might be a bit of a sort of story, but it genuinely lived as if today is our last day. So we always did like a movie level goodbye, and I love you, and you. And so, you know, what a thing for me and my mum to have that both of our last words to my dad would always be, I love you, even though it was, in my case, several hours before he died. And I think that's the sort of thing that we do need to get back to. Life's very hurried and very rushed. And I do savour, and I do, you know, I am giddy with excitement at things, and I am grateful. And I think those are the sorts of things that will get us through if we can.
I think that's a brilliant place to end on, Lucy. Thank you so much. And that's part of the point of what I'm doing. It's making us value what we have today and also be prepared for the fact that life won't go on forever.
No. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you ever so much for talking to me. Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.